Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 231 of The Law Entrepreneur. Can you believe that? 231. I'm Neil Tyree, your host once again. Today, my guest is Devin Miller. Devin is the founder of a law firm, solo practice. Well, actually a little more than a solo practice, small firm practice out in Utah that focuses on intellectual property. And he started off as a patent attorney and has an electrical engineering background, studied Chinese language, then went to law school, and really kind of an interesting and diverse story of how he arrived at the creation of a law firm that serves clients all around the world who are seeking to obtain intellectual property documents and services, such as patents, trademarks, and the like. So I learned a lot, and I hope that you enjoy it as much as I did. So let's not wait around, and let's talk to Devin Miller. Devin Miller, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be on.
Yeah, it's really exciting. As I was mentioning to you in our pre-show chat, I understand you are located out in Utah, and by the time this show airs, it will be almost a year to the day that I was out in your great state, beautiful place to be. So with that, by way of introduction, Devin, tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Yeah, and it's always the short questions that make for the long answer. So I'll try and give you the short answer, sure. Which is, so I'm kind of an entrepreneur and also founded my own law firm. So I kind of have those two, competing interests. I think they make or go well together. But as a short introduction, so background is electrical engineering, Chinese, MBA, and law degree is the educational background. But really, with that, I've kind of chased two dreams in parallel, which is one is I've founded or co-founded a few different startups, some of which have remained small. Others have gone to 7- and 8-figure businesses. And then a lot of my main focus now is also on Miller IP Law, where we focus on founded the firm a few years ago and we focus on helping startups and small businesses with patents and trademarks.
So those other entrepreneurial activities that you have grown, were they in the legal space or more along the engineering lines?
More along the engineering lines. So one of them that was a wearable, or I guess is a wearable for hydration monitoring, more for athletes. It uses some non-invasive sensors, kind of like an iWatch or a Fitbit, only much more, has a lot more smarts behind it, a lot more sensors that kind of helps you monitor for your hydration level. Another one is on non-invasive or wearables for diabetes monitoring. So those are kind of two. I do have one product that we are getting ready to launch. Haven't launched yet. It's in beta right now. That is along the more of the legal field. So it's a way that firms can help to manage their docket system. So everybody hates docketing system. Every firm I used to work for, and now as I run my own firm, you have a docketing system which nobody uses. Everybody has their own system. And so we're working on one that will actually be usable and people want to use, as opposed to having it kind of as, something that nobody wants to use.
Interesting. Now, how did Chinese language study get in the mix?
Yeah, so started out, so I'm LDS, a member of Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And so I actually served a religious mission for a couple of years in Taiwan. So Nice. Taiwan is Chinese speaking as well as mainland China. So I just learned and studied it there. I came back to school. So I went to a year of BYU or university, you know, schooling before, studied electrical engineering. I came back, added Chinese on as a second major where I'd already learned it with my religious mission.
Right. So that's just, now how I'm just going to go off on a tangent here for a moment.
Sure.
How much of full language immersion did you experience when you were on mission?
About as full language as you can get. So, I mean, you have 9 weeks. No, I take it back. 12 weeks that you're in a kind of a training center for missionaries that they help you to get the basics of the language. Although as soon as you get to the actual country, when I got to Taiwan, it didn't sound anything like what I learned at that center.
Of course not.
Then you get there, and basically from there on, you work with intus, and so we call them companions, which are basically just another missionary that you work with or that you go around on the mission with. They're usually a little more senior and know the language better. But other than that, everybody you talk with, everybody you interact with is Chinese, speaks Chinese, and so you dive in and you learn the language as you go.
And so you built on that when you came back to the university. You added that as a second major.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, well, I've studied this enough. I know a lot of it. I'm interested in it. Why not add it on as a second major and do that alongside engineering?
Well, I'm very jealous. I mean, I would also think that to some degree, that it would help in a business sense in terms of if you're building electronic and engineering products that might rely on, resources that are in Chinese speaking countries.
Yeah, you had it not as often as I'd want, but I have had an opportunity a few times to go over to China, mainland China, with some of our distributors or people that are doing parts and whatnot, and actually communicate with them and sit down with them, and it certainly comes in handy in that sense. So I'd love to use it even more than I do, but I do have an opportunity to use it, and it makes for a good background in Chinese.
I suppose that there's not a big Chinese community in Utah. Or am I mistaken?
If you go to BYU, which pulls from people from all over the world, sure. That has some Chinese overtones. Huh? Interestingly enough, the place that I had quite a few Chinese people, so I went out and did my JDMBA out in Cleveland, Ohio, and they have a lot of LLMs or foreign language, masters that coming in to get for a law degree. And they actually in Ohio had a pretty good size of the population that was Chinese speaking. So I got to use it more in law school than anywhere else. So.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? Well, like myself, I haven't quite figured out what I want to be when I grow up. So law is my fourth career. So I can see that there's some parallels in your journey. When did you decide that you wanted to go to law school?
Yeah, it was probably as I was getting towards the end of engineering school. So I got to the end of engineering school and I said I didn't want to be an engineer. Now, I liked engineering, so don't get me wrong. It wasn't like I said, oh, I hate engineering, but it was more of I didn't see myself as wanting to be on a given project for months or years or for a very long period of time where I'm a small widget working on a big project. I'm on it for a long time. I liked a lot more of the diversity of being able to work on multiple things, see different things, see what they have going on and everything else. So as I kind of was looking towards the end of engineering school, started to kind of look and see what my options were, and patent attorney was one. Sure. It was a good one in the sense I could utilize electrical engineering, my undergraduate. I could see a lot of inventions, still be a part of it. I also had an interest in law, and I had an interest in entrepreneurship, hence where I got the MBA degree as well as a law degree at the same time.
Yeah, so it sounds like a well thought out, approach to it, combining your undergrad training with, some of your non-educational training, and then parlaying that into what you really wanted to do. So you go to law school with the idea of what, being a patent attorney, or did you go to law school with the idea that, at some point in time, I want to be an intellectual property solo practitioner?
I went pretty well knowing I wanted to be a patent attorney. For a period of time, I thought about business law and kind of going in that. That was probably as close, and that's the entrepreneur type thing. I thought that would be interesting. Got in, took classes in both, and it just cemented or kind of reaffirmed that I liked the the IP side of it better. But if I hadn't been a patent attorney or patent trademark attorney, I probably would have gone into business law.
Now, remind me, I should know this, but I don't really remember. Is there an additional training or additional certification, education that you have to go through to be a patent attorney? An additional bar?
Yeah. So, yes. So, there's kind of two requirements. The one is you have to have, you know, a general law degree. Everybody has a law degree. The other one is that you have to have a technical undergraduate. So, it has to be a hard science. So, yep. Electrical engineering, mechanical, civil, software. You can also do physics. So, it has to be a hard science undergraduate. And then, to your point, you have to take an additional bar exam. So, I had to take the Utah State bar exam. And I also took what was called the patent bar. So in order to be a patent attorney, they give you the special little exam where you get to have less than a fun time studying for it and also passing that.
Yeah, so really a true glutton for punishment.
Apparently. 4 degrees and 2 bar exams later, here I am.
You are, right? So did you know you were going to come back to Utah, or did you see yourself practicing, you know, in some other exotic location?
Yeah, I always wanted to come back to Utah. I was very close, and I can't remember if I accepted or almost accepted a job offer in Texas. So I just about went there. It is more of, at the time I graduated, the firms, as they were hiring there, some of the firms weren't, or just hired or otherwise weren't hiring at the time. And so I was going to go to Texas and accept a job offer there, and it would have been a great firm, and we were headed there. But I'd always wanted, all of my family is in Utah. My wife's family is in Utah. So we always wanted to come back and be near family. Sure. So as the opportunity came up, I actually had a different job offer that came up as I was graduating, decided to come back to Utah. So it's always been in the plan to be back to Utah. And I'm just fortunate enough that I was able to come back to Utah as quickly as I did.
Yeah, doing it right off the bat. And I'm not kidding. I mean, where you live in Utah is just, you know, a beautiful location, one of God's gifts to the world, that part of the country. So you go to work for a firm as a patent attorney. Mm-hmm. How long did you stay there?
So I've worked for a few firms. The first firm I worked mm-hmm. for, it was a little under 2 years, somewhere between a year and a half and 2 years. Worked for, it was kind of a boutique. It had about 30 or 40 patent attorneys there.
Pretty good sized firm.
Hmm.
But all gnawing at the back of your mind was, man, I could do this on my own and have a lot more fun.
It took me a little bit longer to get. So I'll walk you through. So I did that firm. It was a boutique firm. Had an opportunity. So I went the opposite direction. I went to a big law firm, AM Law, top 100 law firm, big name. They had literally hundreds of attorneys, offices in Utah and California and Palo Alto and New Jersey and New York and all over. And that was it was a great training ground. I mean, I got great training. I worked with clients like Amazon.com and Intel and Red Hat and other ones. So it was a great firm. But kind of through that, and as I was getting towards the end, I was saying, you know, I like working with this, even though I work with some of the biggest names in the, you know, in the world, I really love working with the startups and the small businesses. I like doing that kind of that build that I can have more impact. I can give more, you know, strategy, and I can sit down with them and actually figure it out. And I can see that, you know, what I work on is not just a very small cog, but it's really what they're bringing to market. So kind of with all that, I started to shift my career to be more of, hey, I want to do my own thing. I want to be my own boss, and I want to pick the kind of clients I work with.
Yeah, I would think that when you're working for big law, that the opportunity to work with smaller clients, you know, kind of, which oftentimes the ones that are on the cutting edge of technology, it's a little harder to do because, frankly, they can't afford the fees of a big law firm. And so it's kind of a catch-22. The more exciting work, to some degree, and again, it's not an absolute, but the more exciting work and the more cutting edge and the kind of thing that I think would, you know, really juice up a patent attorney with a double E background, it's probably not what you're going to find in big law, right?
Yeah, I mean, big law, almost as you kind of suffer. And I'm not talking bad about big law. I think that they do a good job. I like the time there. But the biggest problem is they get too, as you said, they get too expensive. and where you're, you know, as you land the big clients. If you have the big clients, they're going to command most of your attention. So one is the rates are fairly expensive. And so startups and small businesses, everyone that I've ever known, they have more things to spend money on than money to spend. And so they're always trying to figure out what's the best, you know, where they can have get the best bang for their buck. And so they have the problem of it's too expensive. And then they, you know, most startups and small businesses, a lot of them don't know a lot about IP. They know that they need a patent, they need a trademark, they want to protect it, but they don't know a lot about it. And so they're coming in looking for strategy, looking for education and understanding. And yet the big law firms are saying, hey, we don't have our time, attention, and focus is on our big clients because they bring in most of the money. And so they don't really ever spend the time to educate them, to strategize with them and help people understand. So I think that's generally where big law is kind of where they focus on the big clients and makes it hard for attorneys to work with the small clients because they're not set up for it.
Yeah. So I see that as a real opportunity, and it sounds like that's what you gravitated towards. So you make that leap, you decide, okay, I'm going to start my own practice. What were some of your thoughts around the time, and how did you structure your approach to creating your firm?
Yeah. So a few thoughts, and I don't know if I have any in particular. So one was that I came in and as I was structuring, so it wasn't just one day I said, hey, I'm going to go jump off, you know, bridge and go do my own thing. But I was saying, okay, if I'm going to do this, I want to have at least somewhat of a landing spot, meaning there isn't a guarantee, but I want to have some of my own clients. I want to have some people that I can bring over to my firm, or at least potentially, and I want to have somewhat of a landing pad. So while I was getting ready to do this, started very diligently trying to do my own client development, getting those people ready so that as I came over, started my own firm, I would have some clients that I would have, you know, revenue from kind of from day one. So that was kind of the first thing I did. And it worked out reasonably well. Since then, we brought on a lot more clients. We've expanded. I brought on other attorneys. But when it was started out, it was really just me. And then the other thing that I did was I knew that I would need a good paralegal. And so there was a paralegal still with the firm today, and she works full time. But at the time, she had left a few months before I was planning to leave to go to a different firm. And I was looking to say, hey, I don't need a paralegal full time, but I need someone I can trust that will do a good job. So I reached out to her and said, hey, is there any way, or are you interested at all if I give you some contract work, give you some kind of side job work that you can help me out or you'd want to? And worked out well, brought her on, and then got busy enough. I said, hey, now why don't you just come work for me full time? And that worked out. But those are really the two things. Is one is I said, hey, I've got to have clients I want to bring over, and I've got to have at least a good paralegal to help me out so that I can focus on what I do. And that's kind of where it started to build from there.
Today's episode of The Law Entrepreneur is brought to you by our good friends at Ruby. And returning to the podcast, our friends at Spotlight Branding. Now, if you've been a listener of this podcast for any time, you know that I sing the praises of Ruby all the time because they're really responsible in my own practice for helping me grow my business, deliver personalized experience to my clients, you know, building customer loyalty, really, in terms of having a consistent front-facing office partner in Ruby, and allows me to stay connected anywhere, anytime to my business through their services. So I can't say enough about Ruby. I'm delighted to have them and continue to have them as a sponsor of this podcast. And for those of you who have listened for some time, you might recognize that returning to the sponsor position here with our podcast is Spotlight Branding. And Spotlight Branding, as you may remember, I was a client of theirs for many months, if not years, before they became a sponsor of the show. So I speak from experience that if you're looking to build content for your practice and have that managed for you in terms of blog posting, social media posting, email dissemination, email newsletter dissemination, that you can do no worse than Spotlight Branding. They're a terrific resource to draw upon, and I wholeheartedly support them, and I'm grateful for their sponsorship of this podcast. What was your physical setup at the time? Because I get a sense that You know, some practices are more suited to, say, a remote or a virtual practice than others. Mm. You know, for instance, criminal defense is, you know,
sure.
you can't be inviting people. You
probably don't want to be inviting those people to your home. Most
exactly, exactly. So, how were you originally set up, and has that changed over the course of time?
So yeah, so it hasn't changed. This is the answer to the second question a whole lot, a little bit. But when I set it up, so one of the things that when I said, hey, if I'm going to help startups and small businesses, I've got to act. You know, I can't just say it and then just do the same thing every other law firm does. But I've got to figure out how to actually do that. So I said, well, one of the things that's hard is that prices are just too high for startups and small business. So I said, what is causing the prices to be so high with law firms? What's driving their expense? And one thing, to be honest, is they always are downtown. They have huge law firms. It's usually they're very immaculate, all wood, you know, huge conference rooms, all which cost money. And then they have a lot of them top weighted towards a lot of partners. So you'll have the partners that get to make a lot of the money, and that, you know, that drives up cost because they want to have that expense. So I said, okay, let's cut those two things out. So I said, okay, I'm not going to have immaculate, you know, they're nice offices, but they're not downtown. They're not immaculate. They're suited for our needs. That's one thing. So I said, we can reduce costs that way. And then I said, hey, when I do this, I'm going to treat myself like an associate. I'm not going to just, you know, live off of all the associates, but I'm really going to set it up that I don't have to have the huge overhead of a partner, but rather be more of just a contributor to the firm. So those are the two things. And then I looked at it and said, the third thing is that when you do that with the geographic location and you're saying, hey, we're going to be downtown and that's our focus, you kind of limit your ability to reach out to other people. Meaning I can only, if I was in Utah and I was downtown, yeah, I can get the Salt Lake area. But really, I'm spending a lot of money for a very small amount of people, you know, small amount of clientele, versus patent and trademark attorneys can work nationwide. We don't have to do state law. We're on federal level. So I set it up that we could really, I would say 90%+ of my clients, or even probably higher than that, never come into the office. We work remotely or with them. We do a lot of Zoom meetings. We do a lot of emails. We do a lot of every communication. So we communicate a lot, but not face to face. And so I intentionally set it up that I could really go after and approach all the clients, no matter where they're at in the US. And we have clients now, some foreign, some in Japan and China and whatnot, a lot from everywhere from California to Oregon to New York, New Jersey, to Utah and everywhere in between. And so that's kind of how we set it up. And because we set it up that way, even now, as you know, it's evolved in sense we brought on more attorneys, have more support staff, we have a bit more marketing team. But really the core is we've set it up so even when we hit COVID, you know, we actually had a boost in our clients because now people aren't going into the firms, they're not going into the big law firms. They're staying home and doing it remote. We're already well positioned to do that. And so it was actually one where we could or have people that otherwise wouldn't be able to get help. We could help out the startups and small businesses that couldn't come into the offices.
Yeah, well, it sounds like a perfect fit there, you know, and a nice opportunity. Tell me a little bit about how you go about marketing a firm that's looking for clients literally all over the world. I mean, you service the clients primarily online. Are you marketing primarily online, or how does that work for your practice?
Yeah, and without giving, I don't want to tell everybody all my secrets, but sure. I'll give it away. you know, one is, you know, it was a bit of an evolution. I started out, you know, not knowing, I had a few ideas and some things worked well. I tried to do everything from radio ads, and radio ads started out actually pretty well, but then they kind of had a diminishing return. So we did those for a few months, found that we kind of hit the audience that were likely to be our clients, and then did it. We did billboards for a little while, kind of found the same thing that once we saturated those. So we did look at both local and nationwide, and we kind of found a little bit of the same thing. But what we really found is the better, one of the things was, you know, certainly referrals. And we have a lot of clients that I brought over, but they also refer us out. And we said, one of the things is if somebody's referring to us, we need to make sure we have good customer service, that every person that comes in the door is going to be taken care of. They get regular status updates. I'm sure you're probably aware too. Interesting fact is the legal industry, for any sort of communication, when a client or a customer communicates with the lawyer, the average response time is 3 to 5 days. Whether you shoot them an email, leave them a voicemail, it takes 3 to 5 days to get back. And one of the best, and I guess, marketing things we did is really focus in on how can I respond to them right away. Can't respond to them right away within 30 minutes. And we have a rule, you absolutely respond within 24 hours by the end of the day. And that has honestly been our big best marketing tool, is really more taking care of clients and having it organic. The other thing we do is, you know, you do a podcast, and I actually do another podcast, a little bit different, Inventive Journey, but we go through a lot of, whether it's clients and other people, talk about their inventive journey, and it helps people to understand what is all takes place in order to get a startup or a small business up and running, and how people got to that. And that's been another one that's been able to, sure, you know, promote and reach new audiences and do well as well. So those are probably the main things that we ended up focusing on. As far as, like, we're getting ready to start to do some Google AdWords and Google that, we haven't had the need. We've had or pursued the other avenues, but I'd like to start exploring that. And we haven't ever got as much onto social media. Aside from, we have a very large presence on LinkedIn, which is the one other place that we do a lot of work on and do a lot or, and have good client generation.
Yeah, I would think that LinkedIn would be a really good fit for you, given, you know, the nature of that platform and the kind of targeting that you can do. But it's interesting too, because I think that the challenge for having such a diverse client base really means that you have to look at a lot of different opportunities. And you know, you're lucky enough to be able to go through that period of time where you can experiment with radio, experiment with billboards, which have in some regions are really very important for legal advertising, and others not so much. But what I really like is, you know, the recognition that client service is so important. I had a mentor one time who did appear on this podcast many years ago, who said the key is just answer the damn phone.
You know, there's so much truth to that, and you'd think that is almost common sense. If somebody's calling you saying, "I want to give you business, I want to give you money," you think, "Great, I'm going to call them back. I'm going to make sure that they are a client." And yet, how many attorneys? I'd almost say it, and it was.
Well, when I went to the Clio conference last year,
other firms I worked with, and even when I brought attorneys on, I had to treat them. What's that?
I was saying, when I went to the Clio conference last year, and they presented their annual report on the state of the legal industry, and the number one complaint that clients have about attorneys is they don't respond to their phone calls. And so the people who put together the survey did a a test where they randomly called, you know, say 100 law firms around the country, and they compiled the statistics, and they had like something like 40 some odd percent, I can't remember what the exact number was, never returned their call. And so the old adage that Mark Miranda said, answer the damn phone, just speaks volumes. And I think, you know, you're an illustration of that.
Yeah, it's interesting. Even when I started my own firm, I started bringing attorneys, they were still bad. And I trained them, they do awesome now, but I still had to ingrain in them. I'm putting a lot of time and money and effort to generate these potential clients that are coming to the firm asking for help. You better pick up the phone and respond to their email or their you know, call or whatnot, because otherwise I just wasted a whole lot of money trying to make or get new clients in the door that you screwed up. So absolutely, I agree with that.
So, you know, for a firm that for which technology is an underpinning and so important to the clients that you're serving, what role is does technology play in the management and operation of your firm itself?
So I'll give the general answer in the legal industry, and then I'll say how we do it. Most law firms don't utilize hardly any technology, which you would think, that they work with a lot of cool technology, that they would have lots of systems and technology in place, and yet they don't. It's probably, and I think my personal opinion is that you have a lot of partners that are older, they've been doing it a long way, they're comfortable with the way they do it, and they just haven't really ever updated their systems. It works for them, that's what they're used to. When I came into it, I'm saying, okay, I'm going to do, again, do things differently. I'm going to see how I can do it. So we use, in a good way, because automatic, or a lot of times sound bad, but we have our client intake automated. So when somebody does a call with us, we make sure that we get their information. We have it set up that we will, as they come in, it will automatically do a conflicts check. After the conflicts check, it sends them a representation agreement, automatically then sends them an invoice for the matter. So they have all the three things, and we don't even have to do that. And it automatically sends reminders so that if they forget or they don't do it, that we follow up with them. All of that is something that we don't have to do. And it's one that we do so often. I say, okay, if it's a repetitive task, why not just automate it? Why not make it so, one, they get better customer service because we're following up, making sure they're taken care of. And two, I'm not putting that burden on a paralegal or an attorney to do. So that's one that we have spent an exorbitant amount of time, money, and effort to say, where are the points that we need to have those human-to-human contact interactions? We're going to make sure we are available for those and do those. For the things that we don't need to, how can we offload that so we don't have to do that?
What product or service are you using for that intake process, or did you roll your own?
It's not how it's set up to do it, but we made it work to our benefit. So we use HubSpot, which is a client relationship management. It's generally set up more for sales and for others. And I say, hey, we're a sales company. We provide a service, but it's not set up for that. We're able to make it work for us. It works really well after we customize it to our needs.
Yeah, so sometimes you can fit that square peg in a round hole.
Sometimes, yeah. It takes a little extra work, but it works out well.
Oh, well, exactly. And I think that's that's fair. If you found a tool that works for you, a platform that works for you, that provides all that kind of consistency and meets your needs, the fact that it's not legal-oriented is immaterial.
Exactly. And I looked at it. Wasn't that I wouldn't use a legal service if there's one out there. I just looked at all and said, well, this really doesn't do what I need it to do. I'm going to look and see how. And I also like to, as a general rule for me, I like to look outside the legal industry and say, what are other people doing well in other industries and how can I apply that to what we're doing? So I said, what are others that have a lot of new clients, customers coming in that need to follow up and what are they doing? Law firms aren't doing it. So let's go look at a different industry that's more in sales and marketing and replicate what they're doing. So that was one of the things that led us to HubSpot.
Is there another platform or application or service that you can think of that's really central to the success of your firm?
I'll give it, I don't know if it exactly answers the question, but one that comes to mind. So we utilize, and it sounds kind of funny, Shopify is a general e-commerce platform. It's for building websites. And I very seldom do law firms ever use it for the law firm purposes. And so it's a platform. And the reason I went with that was I built the website. And that's, you ask one of the other places that we get a lot of clients from, it is we do a lot from our website, but we set it up as an e-commerce build to it, which is different than a lot of other websites. In the sense that you go to a lot of law firm websites, they have very nice looking web pages, very pretty pictures. They tell you a lot about how they've been in the news or what they're doing that's awesome. And yet at the end of the day, you don't know how much things cost. You can't schedule anything. You don't know who to call or how to reach out to them. And you have to spend 10 minutes digging through the website to find that information. So I said, why don't we flip that on its head? Let's do an e-commerce. We can make it prices easy to understand, make the flow something that people are used to, and make it easy to schedule a strategy session with us because it's just right there. So that's one of the other platforms that, maybe it's not as quite as technology, but it is more of looking at outside of e-commerce and how to do that in the legal field.
No, I think that's exactly right. And it's funny that you mentioned that because on my list of things to chat with you about is your website. I spent a lot of time in preparation for this call going through the website. And I love the way it's organized. And you do adhere to several of those principles. Again, I'm going to refer back to the Clio conference that went to in Jack Newton's book that he wrote about client-centered. I forget the title of it, where he says that that's the question that most clients are struggling with because they don't see right away, or they don't get a sense of right away what this legal representation is going to cost, nor what is the process by which they're going to be put through. And yours is right there, right up front. I love that you have you know, essentially your mission statement right on the front page. You can't help but see it. And the very next thing shows the services that you offer and the prices that you charge for it. So so you're doing flat fees for all this.
Yeah, 90, 95%. There's a few exceptions that don't fit into it. But yeah, one of the things, again, if I were to look and say startups and small businesses specifically that they hate, and I've read the same kind of the Clio report you're referring to, is that they don't know when the bill ever stops. Meaning if you have it on the billable hour, and they, or even if you try and set it up on flat fees and that, it's so complicated. They feel like they're always being nickel and dime. They're always having, they don't know what it's going to really cost them. And so, I said, okay, let's solve that problem. That's certainly solvable. So we set everything up on flat fees. You want a patent application. Here's your flat fee. It includes governmental fees, includes all the attorney's time, includes everything you need to prepare and file it. Same thing with a trademark application or copyright. And now it's saying, okay, now they know how much it's going to cost. They can budget for that. They can set it aside. They know what it will be. And then the other thing we do is once they get going, so let's say taking a patent application as an example, they get an email once we do a strategy session and they say, I'd like to do a patent application. We have a clearly laid out, here's the next step. We're going to do a conflicts check. And then we're going to do a disclosure meeting. And then we're going to do, we're going to prepare a draft. We're going to send it to you. Then you wait for this period of time. Then we'll hear back from the patent office. So, and then they also know any costs along that are also shown on there. So we say, here's our flat fees. Here's every step along the way, what it will likely cost you. And it's an average, but some of them is a patent office goes and have multiple rounds. But we say, here's what you should plan for. And then they know it all up front and it makes it much clearer and easier to understand.
And those are the decision points that clients like yours, and really all clients, but even more so for clients like yours, they need to have that data in order to make a decision to move forward.
Exactly. Yep.
Yeah. So I'd be remiss if I didn't complete my thought about the title of Jack's book is The Client-Centered Law Firm, How to Succeed in an Experience-Driven World. And I've recommended that book in the past. So we'll have that in the notes for anybody who wants to follow up with that. Well, Devin, listen, this has been great. I've learned a lot, particularly about how to integrate some of the things that you've done and excelled at. So tell our audience, what's the best way for them to get in contact with you if they want to follow up on anything you had to share with us today?
Yeah, so I'll give three easy ways. Mm-hmm. So if they want to just check out the website that we talked about, see our flat fees, they can also schedule strategy session, check out our podcast, FAQs, any of the above. Just go to millerIPL.com. So M-I-L-L-E-R, then I as in intellectual, P as in property, L as in law.com. That's our general website. If they want to specifically talk about patents and trademarks or have questions, they can go to freestrategymeeting.com. That's a way they can schedule a strategy meeting with me. We'll jump on a video conference, answer any of their questions, doesn't cost them anything, and walk through and strategize as to what may make sense. And then lastly, if they want to just reach out to me generally, any questions, whether it's about the law firm, anything else I do, or just in general, they can just go to meetdevin.com and grab some time as well.
Well, that's terrific, Devin. I really do appreciate you sharing that. And we'll make sure they're in the show notes for people to look up as needed. So I want to thank you again for taking the time to be with us today. I wish you all the best. And next time I'm out in Utah, I'll take a run up to Park City and maybe we can have that cup of coffee together.
All right. I look forward to it. And you're always welcome to stop by.
All right. Thanks ever so much, Devin, for being a guest today on The Law Entrepreneur. Well, there you have it, law entrepreneurs. Thanks for being with us today and with this episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I want to thank our sponsors, as usual, Ruby Receptionists and Spotlight Branding. Make sure you swing on by our website at thelawentrepreneur.com or visit our Facebook page or Twitter account. You can find us anywhere by just searching on The Law Entrepreneur. Also, if you'd be kind enough, I'd love it if you could go to your podcast application and leave us a rating and a review. It helps with our visibility, and it helps ensure that we're there to be found when people come looking for podcasts in the legal space. So once again, thanks for being a part of today's episode of The Law Entrepreneur.